This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Amari, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society.
We would like to welcome Dr. Megan Daniels to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Dr. Daniels is currently an assistant professor of ancient Greek material culture in the Department of Classical, Near Eastern, and Religious Studies at UBC. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Daniels.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Could you start by telling us a bit about yourself and how you got into archaeology?
Well, I hail from Ontario. My mother comes from Scotland, so I spent a lot of my early summers running around a landscape that was much older than Ontario's, than the suburbs of Toronto that I grew up in. So I was always very interested in history. And I was a big fan of Greek mythology, of course, and I love traveling. And so when it came to choosing a major in university, that's kind of what I gravitated towards. I majored from day one, which is quite unusual for a lot of students. I went to Wilfrid Laurier University. I took archaeology and I specialized in what's called classical archaeology, which essentially denotes the cultures of ancient Greece and Rome. But of course, it's important to stress that the Mediterranean world was much larger and much more diverse than simply the Greeks and Romans. So I studied archaeological techniques. I studied ancient Greek and Latin and Greek and Roman history. So it was pretty interdisciplinary that way. And my first experiences digging actually were as an employee for the Government of Canada in sites around Ontario and the national parks and native sites. I spent some time working in Bermuda and British colonial sites as well. And it wasn't until finally after the last summer of my undergrad that I finally went to Greece and did my first archaeological excavation there. Took some time out between degrees and this just kept going with it, really. I just kept coming back to school and I loved learning. So I actually did my master's at UBC and my PhD in California, but once again with many breaks in between.
Yeah, that seems like a really interesting path. Could you maybe start by telling us a bit about some of the research you're currently working on?
Yeah, I'm working on a number of different avenues. Like you read out my title, which is a bit of a mouthful, Assistant Professor of Ancient Greek Material Culture. My main focus is the archaeology of the Greek world, which includes mainland Greece and includes all of these islands in the Aegean Sea, even includes parts. I mean, the Greeks were famous in antiquity for migrating around the Mediterranean world, right? And they set up settlements in places like Sicily, southern Italy, parts of North Africa and Egypt, even as far as the Black Sea and the coast of modern day Turkey, which is often referred to as Asia Minor. So it's a very big world, right? And it involves a lot of different interactions with different types of people. And so I see myself as much more than just a scholar of ancient Greek material culture. And so I'm very interested in how cultures interact and how peoples interact in the Eastern Mediterranean, especially. And I'm especially interested in what I see as really fascinating time periods, what we tend to call the Late Bronze Age, which goes from about 1500 to 1100, and the Iron Age, which picks up in 1100 and goes to, at least in the Eastern Mediterranean world, about 500. I'm largely interested in these periods because the Late Bronze Age was this fascinating time period of very large states ruled by divine kings. We have the pharaohs in Egypt. You have states like the Hittite Empire, Assyria, and also a number of very powerful citadels in the Greek world as well. Around 1200, a lot of these places, this whole kind of interconnected state-level societies around the Eastern Mediterranean, in a sense, come crashing down. I mean, it's often described as a complete societal collapse around 1200 BCE. We don't really know why. And then you have this whole kind of really fascinating period in the Iron Age of economic regeneration, of political regeneration. Greece develops a number of different city-states, of course, and then by the mid-first millennium BCE, there's this the rise of, we talk about the rise of the city-state, these new types of egalitarian governments. Most people will associate ancient Greece with things like democracy, right? The rule by the many. And so my research really investigates kind of how that trajectory took place, how and why that trajectory happened. And I look largely at religion, especially, and how people use religion to elaborate ideologies and identities, how they use it to interact with one another. So I'm happy to elaborate on any of these points that I just went over.
Yeah, you touched on a lot of points I was curious about. First of all, you mentioned like the Stone Age, Bronze Age, Iron Age. What was it that interested you most about the Iron Age? Because from my understanding, that's what you spend most of your time researching.
Yes, the Iron Age, certainly. So those terms are very old. They were developed in the modern world in the 1800s by researchers who were really starting to study a lot of artifacts and starting to organize them. And they realized that, you know, large amounts of bronze came from this period, you know, bronze artifacts and graves as grave goods, for example. Large amounts of iron artifacts came from different periods. So they started to elaborate things called the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, and the Iron Age. In fact, even some ancient Greek writers talked about these types of things. They talked about golden ages and bronze ages and silver ages, right? And a lot of the times it was done in a somewhat judgmental tone, and iron was seen to be this degenerate kind of, you know, it's not as pretty as gold and silver. It's not as rare or as expensive. And these terms have really stuck. They don't, certainly more iron does begin to be used in the Iron Age, so it is somewhat relevant to it. But as I said, the reason I'm really interested in it is because of the social and political developments that come out of it. You have this widespread collapse. So, you know, once again, we're not sure. Many of these sites in the late Bronze Age end up burned and abandoned. So a lot of these great citadels, the capital of the Hittite Empire, the Egyptians write about these people attacking their shores. There's a lot of things that go on. And that's why we talk about this Bronze Age collapse. And I'm just really fascinated in the kind of the regeneration of society in the Iron Age and studying that and studying kind of what that entailed. And also trying to bring, like I said, most, you know, the average person off the street, if you mention, you know, what comes to mind when you think of ancient Greece is democracy, city states, you know, maybe some famous individuals like Socrates and Plato. And I'm really interested in looking at the longer term perspective of how all of that came about and seeing how the Greek world is really integrated into a much larger and much more vibrant Eastern Mediterranean world. And trying to really look, like I said, my title has Greek in it, but I try to look way beyond that to understand the Greek world and the Iron Age in general.
So when you talk about this Eastern Mediterranean world, I think you mean when the Greeks, they had their empire going on, were there other sort of civilizations coexisting at the same time as well?
Oh, absolutely. So you're thinking like when the Greeks are developing democracy, Athens mm-hmm. is an empire around the mid first millennium, kind of in the 5th century mm-hmm. BCE. Absolutely. They're in touch with so many different people. The big one in that period is Persians, of course. Many people will know the Persian wars that happened in the early 5th century. Persia was the largest land empire ever seen to date, obviously surpassed by the Roman Empire. But this was a huge, huge political entity that the Greeks were very well aware of. Of course, there's the Egyptians as well. Egypt being focused around the Nile that flows north from south to north into the Mediterranean world. Once again, we know from writers like Herodotus that the Greeks very much looked to Egypt as a source, as a much older civilization. There's a real sense of reverence in certain respects. Herodotus says all the Greek gods, or most of the Greek gods, came from Egypt, for instance. We know we have sources that tell us that many Greeks were moving abroad in those times too, serving as mercenaries in the Pharaoh's army. They were trading. The Greeks set up a colony or settlement in the Nile Delta, for example. So Egyptians, Persians, people to the north of Greece, often referred to as the Thracians in modern day Bulgaria, people around the Black Sea. Herodotus is this big 5th century source for our knowledge of the Greeks' knowledge of the peoples around them. He talks about the Scythians, right? Semi-nomadic, although sometimes also settled people as well. And then, of course, there's the peoples of North Africa, which we know very little about, in which more and more research is being done on. and the peoples to the western Mediterranean as well, the early Italic peoples, the Etruscans, the peoples of Sicily, the peoples of Gaul and Iberia, or roughly modern day France and Spain and Portugal. So there's peoples all over the Mediterranean world that the Greeks are interacting with.
Excellent. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message, so please stay tuned.
A Tribe Called Red is the hallucination with their new record, One More Saturday Night, featuring Javier Mighty, Tanya Tagak, and more, out now.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alirad, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we are interviewing Dr. Megan Daniels, an assistant professor of ancient Greek material culture in the Department of Classical, Near Eastern, and Religious Studies at UBC. So, Gurman, I think you had a question.
Yeah, in high school history, we're taught that the ancient Greeks were the ones who invented democracy, and it was sort of painted as this like ideal democratic land. I'm guessing this is a lot more complex than that.
It is, and that's really what I try to intervene in with my research. There is this sense, it's often referred to as the Greek miracle, right? This kind of generation in the Greek world alone of this amazing democracy and scientific thought, but it's just not true. I mean, for one thing, and the more and more researchers are starting to look at this vast amounts of interconnectivity between all of these parts of the Mediterranean. There's books certainly written now that look at different flourishings of democracy in different parts of the world as well. The Greeks weren't the ones who invented it. They certainly, for a time period, particularly Athens, had a very, very radical democracy going on, although it wouldn't be what we would characterize as a democracy. For example, women had no rights in that society. Their society was very much built on the work of enslaved people. We know this from archaeological excavations of nearby silver mines from Athens. So this is something that I try to convey to my students, right? When we talk about the golden age of Athens, it's like, well, whose golden age was this, right? And even when Athens did have a quite, radical democracy that really limited when we say radical democracy, I mean, they really did take steps to limit the power of particular individuals. They even had this thing called ostracism, where they could vote people out of the democracy. They could actually tell people who were getting too powerful that they had to leave for 10 years. They didn't lose their rights for citizenship. They just had to leave for 10 years. So there's quite radical, but at the same time, when Athens is at its most radical, it's also at its most imperialistic too, right? They did have an empire. They did subjugate a number of their fellow Greeks as well, under the pretext that they had to guard against the Persians invading again. So, it's a lot of things to think about that. Yeah, it's often thought, oh, it was invented in Greece, but it wasn't. There's some excellent resources. I don't know if we can put this in the show notes, maybe, of other examples of democracy in other parts of the world. And it's a short-lived period for Greece, right? That's the other thing. People look at this kind of narrow slice of time in the 5th and 4th centuries and think, yeah, and it's only some city-states. Many other city-states had kings. For example, Sparta had a dual kingship. Other city-states had more what we would call an oligarchy, which is the rule by a few people, kind of a small council of people. So lots of different, it is much more complex. I mean, that really hits the nail on the head.
Yeah, a lot of your work revolves around this term called divine kingship. And I was wondering if you could define that for our viewers.
Yes, so I'm really interested in the long-term study of divine kingship in the Eastern Mediterranean world, which we've just described. So not just the Greek world, but also Egypt, Mesopotamia, Anatolia, which is modern day Turkey. And when we talk about divine kingship, we have to imagine a spectrum. First of all, I think it's good to kind of get into the mindset, to get out of our mindset of when we're just about to have an election, but a liberal democracy, right? We kind of take this as the norm, at least people living in North America and other parts of the world. And to realize that kingship has been one of the major forms of government for a number of societies for throughout history. And people point to this kind of realism, this truth, right? So when we think of, when we talk about divine kingship, we really have to think of a spectrum. One famous researcher that I like to quote is a famous researcher of Mesopotamian history, Piotr Michalowski. He writes, "All kings are sacred and mediate between sacred and profane, but not all kings are gods." So we do have certainly on one end of the spectrum, the king who is essentially a god, can fashion themselves as a god. Oftentimes the Egyptian pharaoh is taken as this example, but once again, just like we talked about with Greek democracy, it's a lot more complex in Egypt too, and the pharaoh doesn't always get, you know, depending on who's ruling, they don't always get that privilege, or they have to fight for that privilege. And then there's this kind of lower end of the spectrum, or other end of the spectrum, where kings are just, they're monarchical rulers, they have sacred duties, they have a special connection to the gods, maybe. Certainly they have religious offices, but they're not considered divine. And what I'm really interested, you know, in terms of looking at the Bronze and Iron Ages in the Eastern Mediterranean is to look at how and why this ideology worked for so long. And I look at the kind of the large patterns of how it plays out in these different societies, including Bronze Age Greece, which was, this is the era, especially late Bronze Age Greece. It's often referred to as Mycenaean Greece after the famous citadel known as Mycenae. People might know this from Homer's Iliad. Mycenae, the king Agamemnon, led the Greeks to war against Troy, right? He kind of united them all and they went to war against Troy, allegedly over the Trojan prince stealing Helen of Sparta, which was another major palace city state at that time. So there certainly was kingship across all of these societies in the late Bronze Age. We had this kind of collapse period in 1200 BCE. And then we have a lot of the same kind of ideologies perpetuated into the Iron Age, right? And so I'm really interested in looking at how, especially when we think about the Greeks developing democracy, you know, a lot of my research has shown that in myth and ritual, they still really adhere to a lot of these same ideas about divine kingship. And the question is, how do they come in places, for example, 5th century Athens, to reject those ideas? So I look at a lot about how the Greeks, especially in the 6th and 5th centuries, engage with ideas of divine kingship, and how they, in a sense, critique them and in some cases reject them.
Yeah, I was kind of curious about how, like, law and the legal system worked in Greece, because I know, like, in Athens, around that time period you mentioned, there was, like, the draconian laws, but mm-hmm. I was wondering if there are any, like, similar legal systems in Greek societies where, like, monarchies or tyrannies were the norm.
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting question, because after about 1200, 1100 BCE, as we come into the Iron Age, following this collapse of these Bronze Age largely monarchical societies, scholars used to call the period around 1100 to 900 in Greece a dark age, right? This is, you know, somewhat equivalent to the fall of the Roman Empire, right? Things dissolve, you lose writing, you lose large-scale monumental building, art largely disappears, people abandon settlements, there seems to be population decline. So many of these citadels, including Mycenae, which was excavated in the 1800s, are abandoned and burned, right? And so you get the sense that life is really shifted in this period to smaller scale societies. And then, so they used to call it a dark age largely because we couldn't see anything archaeologically. It's hard to see when people go from building in stone to building in mud and thatch. That doesn't really last in the archaeological record. If you're not building large monumental art and architecture, it's really hard to see things as an archaeologist. And around 800 BCE, so coming into this first millennium period, you start to see more evidence. You start to see larger temples. You start to see the growth of cities. We start to talk about the rise of the city-state. So your question was about tyranny and legal systems, right? I'm getting kind of a tangent here. But yeah, so in that period, there is the rise of a lot of tyrants in different city states. We cited the laws of Draco, right? We get our term draconian from that, right? You had these very harsh laws. Tyrants rise in other city states too. Corinth, for example, this other island city state of Samos. And so, yeah, you get the sense that there, and tyranny is not necessarily the negative term. Like we think of the term tyrant today is quite negative, right? And it's something that we assert with someone who's acting tyrannical. It comes from the Lydian word tyrannos. And it largely means someone who seizes power unconstitutionally, who maybe has popular support and seizes power for themselves. And many of these tyrants actually were quite popular, right? They were populists, as I guess is what we would call them. And so you get the sense, once again, these periods are quite murky in the Greek world, but you get the sense that there is a lot of political change. There's a lot of vying for power and no one can really get the upper hand in this period. And these city states themselves, as far as we know, seem to also be constantly at war with one another over territory. Sparta certainly is trying to advance its power in the Peloponnese. And so in terms of there actually being a legal system, it's really hard to see, right? We get snippets, right? We cited the laws of Draco and things like that. There's early evidence of law, of inscriptions on Crete that talk about legal system, you know, laws and how often one can hold audience. You get the sense that there's real struggles and turmoil in this period, but also an attempt to kind of build legal and political systems, which is really fascinating.
Great. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message.
By the way, this is somebody's favorite show. Hi, Dan Shakespeare here. You know, for most of the stuff that I play, you probably think that I'm much older, but you know what? Most of you are probably way off, because I'm only 23 years old. Tune in to The Shakespeare Show between noon and 1 p.m. on Wednesdays. It's songs from before the 1920s to alternative stuff today, plus jokes and riddles, all sorts of fun stuff. Just put any of it on your iTunes if you need to. Pretty soon it'll be coming out on albums.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM.
I guess now, you know, pivoting a bit to the research aspect I have, you know, this one question I had is that as an archaeologist, how do you conduct research? You know, is most of it done, you know, like in the university, like office lab settings, or do you do a lot of like field work as well?
It's real balance of both. And in fact, I think even Indiana Jones, who's not a good archaeologist, he also, you know, you've got the kind of dutiful scene in the university where he says, 70% of all archaeology is done in the library or something. And of course, then he's off for the rest of the movie thing. So much of it takes place in labs, in libraries. It really depends what your own research focus is. Some archaeologists are their research, the questions that they want to answer necessitate excavation, right? And that means there's different types of excavation. Most of what people think of is going to a site and obviously systematically digging layers down, trying to analyze what they're finding, employing a large team of people, students, specialists who study different types of artifacts or architecture, and, you know, generating, you know, reports and excavation volumes with all of this information, right? This kind of data that other people can then study. And so a lot of research does necessitate that kind of work, but a lot of it doesn't. In my research, because I'm I like to think big and look beyond single sites, single societies, and really understand large concepts like divine kingship. This requires me to look a lot more into textual sources like myths. And so I do a lot of work with texts, as well as religious iconography. And that involves looking at a lot of different sites and often using these excavation reports that come out of the excavations of sanctuaries and things like that, and using like that databases, museum catalogs, to study different trends in iconography as well. So a lot of my work, because I'm really interested in kind of big picture stuff, is actually done more in the library, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I do work in the field. I'm happy to talk about any of the specific field work that I've done as well. But it's often kind of different foci focus than what I'm actually working on research wise.
What's your most favorite fieldwork experience?
My favorite fieldwork experience? I think my favorite site that I ever worked on was in Tunisia. I'm mm-hmm. happy to talk about this more. I got the opportunity to work on, I was part of the excavation team. I also studied the pottery that came out of the site. So that is one of my other interests is pottery and what we can tell about human societies from this material, which is one of the most ubiquitous materials on archaeological sites. But this particular site was quite interesting. And this goes into my interest in looking beyond the Greek world. It is a Phoenician site in southern Tunisia. We talked about the Greeks, you know, colonizing, settling around the Mediterranean, while the other great kind of cultural groups that did this were the Phoenicians, who come roughly from the area of modern day Lebanon. Their most famous city was Carthage, which most people know as the city that waged a series of wars with Rome and was eventually defeated and taken over by Rome. And that was also in North Africa and in the northern part of Tunisia. And so I worked on a site in the southern part of Tunisia that was essentially a sanctuary to a Phoenician goddess that we know as Tanit. And that was, it was really interesting, because one of the things that the literary sources say about the Phoenicians is that they sacrificed, and I hope this might necessitate a content warning for this podcast, but they sacrificed infants to Tanit, to their gods. And you have a lot of Roman sources who talk about this often in a very derisive tone. And so you get this, and then you come into this question as well, was it just that, you know, the Romans had a bias or a prejudice against the Phoenicians? Or did this actually happen? So we were investigating this site, which is just such an interesting, you know, tons and tons of deposits of urns that people, these kind of vases that people would bring, and they would also set up these kind of stone slabs that we call stelae, to this goddess. And also what was interesting was there is a Roman town nearby as well. And the whole idea is that the Romans were said to stamp out infant sacrifice once they took over Carthage and large parts of northern Africa that the Phoenicians had colonized. So we were really interested in, seeing this kind of relationship between these two peoples, right, who were in some cases were enemies, but in other cases lived in close connection with one another. And so we're still, deposits that we excavated are still being analyzed, but this is kind of one of the questions that we're hoping to answer is how did Phoenician religious practice change? So that's probably one of my favorite sites mm-hmm. that I ever got to work on.
What's the process like when conducting this research? How long does it take? How do you visit the site?
Yeah, that can take years. Excavation that generally happens in the Mediterranean world, at least in the summer periods. We teach, like most other professors, mm-hmm. we teach during the school year in our universities and go overseas in the summer to do field work. And, you know, this is a whole other process of applying for permits, of making contacts in countries where you want to work. So we worked with the Tunisian team as well. And the whole publication process can take years, because you have on one hand the seasons where you're excavating, which generally run from somewhere between 4 and 8 weeks in the summer, are quite intensive, usually 6 days a week. You get up at dawn, you work until the early afternoon when in the Mediterranean it's just too hot, and then you have siesta. This is the way it's done in the Mediterranean, and I'm fully on board with that. And then you usually go back to work afterwards too in the evenings when it's cooler. And that's kind of the rhythm of life there. And it's a lot of it is just excavation and long days of excavation and organizing of finds. And then it's usually in the years after maybe 3 or 4 seasons of excavation that you then analyze the finds. You go back and analyze them and do what's called study season. So you actually go back to the site and wherever the finds are stored and then study them. You for in terms of pottery, you know, all the pottery is being cleaned and sorted and put in its respective context. But a lot of this involves in studying the designs, the types of pottery, trying to date different areas of the site by the pottery types. That's kind of what I was doing on this project. And that I've done on other projects, and then event, and then writing up publications. This could be journal articles. Oftentimes, it goes into a large excavation volume, and that can just take years. So this whole process is very, very long, long, slow process. And unfortunately, you know, some things just take way too long to be published. This is an ongoing problem, right? Is the need to kind of there's so much data out there, essentially, that needs to make it into publications, and that hasn't.
One random question. Who keeps the stuff you find?
Well, that's a good question. and in terms of modern day cultural heritage laws in different countries, they generally, I mean, you almost ubiquitously belong to the country where they're excavated. So anything in Greece, anything we excavate is stored in Greece. And this, once again, you know, where do you store it? This once also depends on where you are. This is something that you have to think about, right? It's not just about going and digging the site and making sure you dig it properly. It's also, well, how do you handle the material that comes out of the ground? So in many cases, it's stored in local museums. The site I'm currently working on publishing, not excavating, but publishing parts, artifacts from a site that was excavated about 20 years ago that's stored in the basement of a museum. So a lot of the times it's stored in museums there. Sometimes archaeologists themselves will generate funding to build a storehouse for this material, but that's something that you have to think about as an archaeologist. And yes, so in most cases, though, this stays in the countries. In some cases, you can get permission to take samples home, but this requires permission by, you know, whatever ministry is in charge. So usually some type of ministry of culture would have to give you written permission to export cultural materials, because that's a lot different than it used to be.
Yeah, I guess, you know, in the past, there was like, I guess, relatively recent, when you look at the scale of history, you know, the UK going and taking stuff from Greece and other countries around there.
It was essentially amounted to plunder in the 19th century, and you know, this started with people like Napoleon going to Egypt with his army and all his scientists, right, and taking the Rosetta Stone and a bunch of other things back. And those expeditions, not just to blame Napoleon, but they started a collection frenzy amongst these European museums. And you had Lord Elgin taking the Parthenon marbles, which are still in the British Museum. So, yeah, it essentially was cultural plunder. And so many new laws in specific countries, but also things like the UNESCO World Heritage, you know, the 1973 convention, these were intended to stop that, and they essentially have.
And I would say the UK is actually, I think, still involved in some legal disputes with Greece, I believe, over the stuff they've taken.
Oh, it's an ongoing issue. I mean, it's still a debate in the 21st century about whether or not to return the Parthenon marbles to Greece. And it doesn't show any signs of abating, unfortunately. I mean, this is a very contentious issue, but the question of how these marbles were taken. Lord Elgin claimed that he had authority to take them by what was then the ruler of Greece, the Ottoman Sultan. And that permission has, as far as I know, never materialized. So, and even if it did materialize, Greece was under occupation by a foreign power in the early 1800s. And so it's a really difficult, touchy topic. And it's something that I certainly bring to my courses, and we talk a lot about with my students too. It's, you know, something that a lot of people are really interested in.
Great. We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message.
Looking to get a reliable and affordable used bike? Need a repair or service to your current ride?
Come to the Bike Kitchen, UBC's full-service community bike shop, located in room 36 of the UBC Life building. Our hours are Monday to Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
If you buy a bike from us, bring it back when you're done using it, and we'll give you half of your money back, as long as you took care of it, If it needs repairs, we'll split the cost with you.
Yep, you heard us right. We'll give you crisp dollar bills for half the original price of any used bike that you buy from us, minus the cost of repairs.
For more information about our buyback policy and to stay up to date on any COVID-19 inspired changes, find us online at thebikekitchen.com.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. And today we're interviewing Dr. Megan Daniels, an assistant professor of ancient Greek material culture at UBC. So, Gurman, I think you had something to say.
Yeah, coming from a life science background, we were sort of taught to worship the scientific method. And I was wondering if there's any like similar like a standardized way of doing research in archaeology.
That's a really good question too. Archaeology has gone through a number of paradigm shifts, and I actually was talking about this week with my students, and I'm not going to get into all the nitty gritties here, but there has been times and places where archaeologists have really sought to make the field more scientific, like make it kind of a grounds for hypothesis testing, right? To kind of generate hypotheses on human societies and how human societies develop, and then test those hypotheses by digging, right? And by trying to dig systematically so that they can test these kind of laws, right, that they're trying to generate. But there's been other times when people have argued for it to be more humanistic oriented, right? To answer questions about, you know, identity and belief and ideology. And so it's really kind of, there's always been kind of a push-pull throughout the last kind of 200 years since these scientific disciplines really came together in the 19th century. And talking today, there certainly is a process that all students of archaeology learn to excavate a site, right? There's certain principles that you learn about how sites are formed, how you come about excavation, how you record things as you're excavating. A lot of it comes with, you know, how do you spatially record where things are coming if we're in a site, you know, in terms of how they're related to one another. How do you keep track of that? How do you keep track of the vertical component of a site? This is, of course, going down. And the general idea is that the deeper you go, the further back in time you go. This is more, once again, as with all things, more complex when you actually come to do it. But generally, you have layers that you dig through that we refer to as strata, and the study of these layers is referred to as stratigraphy. And there's ways to kind of excavate so that you're paying attention to these different layers, right? Watching the soil, watching how things change, keeping records of where in these different layers and also in different areas in space your artifacts and different features on your site are coming from. So there certainly is a method. Yes.
Yeah, I feel like with a lot of fields recently in research, like the sciences or technology, it's like our knowledge is increasing exponentially each year. Yeah. And I was wondering whether that's the same for archaeology.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, we have this constant backlog of things that need to be published, for one thing. So there are so many things that still need looking at. And any kind of graduate student is, you know, there's no shortage of things to work on. I sometimes get people saying, oh, haven't they dug everything up yet? No, absolutely not. There's new techniques. And one of the things that, you know, it's not just new things that we find or new sites to excavate, but we're really influenced. Archaeology as a discipline is something that really straddles the humanities, the social sciences, and the hard sciences. And they're influenced by developments in all of those broad, very broad fields. One of the things that's really influenced archaeology lately has been a lot of hard scientific techniques like genomic sequencing, like ancient DNA. And this has really changed the ways in which we understand human populations in history. It's raised a whole number of new questions and new problems as well. But this is still, it's the new knowledge is not simply coming from new artifacts and new sites. It comes from so many other ways, things too, right? And in the humanities, there's, you know, new ideas about how we understand history, how we understand human identity, how we study ethnicity, all of these things just impact on the field of archaeology.
Yeah, you touched on something really interesting that I was planning on talking about, the Homo Migrants Conference. Seemed like a really interesting topic to go on. Could you explain to the audience what that was?
This was a conference I held as a postdoctoral fellow in 2018 at SUNY Buffalo, the State University of New York at Buffalo. And it was a Homo Migrans is this Latin term, but the real title of the conference was Modeling Mobility and Migration in Human History. And it was really capitalizing on these scientific as well as humanistic shifts in the last decade or so. The scientific shifts largely being the ability to sequence entire ancient genomes. They used to only be able to sequence parts of the genome before, and they were very limited in terms of what they could say about ancient genetics. But starting around about 2010 or thereabouts, they started to be able to sequence entire genomes very cheaply, and just started looking at more and more populations in history. And a lot of this really impacted in how we saw humans moving, because as when humans migrate and settle in new places, they mix and mingle, i.e. mate with other humans. And of course, genomes get, you know, exchanged, and you have all these fascinating genetic signatures that we all then carry, right? We carry all the signatures of our ancestors with us. I'm not a geneticist in any sense of the term. As you saw from my research into divine kingship, I'm big, you know, I'm more into the humanistic concerns, I suppose, or and social science concerns. But we invited people to this conference who were working with ancient genetics. Some of them were geneticists, some of them were archaeologists who were working with large teams that included geneticists, and to talk about how we re-envision migration, how we understand migration. And it had real modern relevance too, because, as you know, over this last decade, we've seen things like the migration crisis. We see these kind of words thrown around in the news of, you know, migrations in the Mediterranean from North Africa and Syria and Europe, and like really heart-wrenching pictures and stories of what people are going through. And This is so much a part of the human story. And I think we going back, you know, thinking about the Greek miracle in Greece and everything developing in Greece, and not thinking about Greece being a part of this larger Eastern Mediterranean world. I think a lot of the times we've just simply ignored the mobility and migration that really makes us human, right? We tend to see cultures as these separate things, the Greeks, the Romans. We even tend to talk about Canadian society or, you know, British society, and without realizing how integrated, you know, on one level everything is. People are so mobile and constantly moving. So I think a lot of these shifts, these scientific shifts, have served to show us how mobile humans are and how that mobility is such a part of our development. And I also, the other point I wanted to drive home about that conference and the relationship to our modern day attitudes towards migration is, we often, you know, we get branded as, oh, ivory tower, you're sitting in your armchair talking about human history and migration, and it doesn't really have an impact, right, on how on the modern world. But it really does. How archaeologists interpret the human past, and especially how humans move, definitely had major repercussions, both in the 19th century when archaeology was coming together as a discipline, and nowadays in terms of how these genetic signatures are interpreted and what they're used for. There's certainly been issues where, you know, right-wing groups have used genetic, you know, ancient DNA to argue that, you know, they are the autonomous people in this region. They've equated essentially ancient DNA signatures with an ethnic group, right? And this is where it gets really, really you get into really dangerous ideological territory here. And that's why archaeologists, geneticists, and anyone else working with this history has a real responsibility. And so that's what this conference is really kind of trying to articulate. And the volume is finally coming out in April of 2022.
You touched on comparisons to the refugees in the Mediterranean. Do you see any other like modern day comparisons to how some of that research applies today?
In terms of how we study ancient migrations, you mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. If I can, I'd like to give an example from the 19th century as well today to kind of drive home how important this topic really is. When archaeology and anthropology and all these other disciplines were kind of coalescing in the 19th century, they were, you know, the university itself. This is where you really start to see ideas, interests in migrations and characterizing ancient migrations come into the research. And a lot of this was done for really nefarious purposes. Mm-hmm. many times, you know, as more and more sites and peoples and cultures and pasts were beginning to be studied, of course, largely this was just people were amazed at the past and there was a real meaning of the, you know, there's obviously a benign reason why this was happening. But they often started to explain, you know, any type of culture change that they saw in the archaeological record by a migration. And this, once again, in and of itself didn't necessarily have to be bad, but certain areas where, you know, especially European colonizers had certain attitudes towards people, they would often use archaeological explanations to deny any, you know, deny that kind of region any type of complexity. An example of this is the ruins of Great Zimbabwe in modern day Zimbabwe, which was argued by researchers in the 19th and early 20th centuries to have been built by migrations, by migrants, right? They didn't think that the, you know, the ancient people of Zimbabwe were advanced enough to build something like this. They argue that it was, the Phoenicians, once again, these came from Lebanon. I think that something they ascribed it to biblical characters who must have built this. And this kind of research was actively used by colonizers like Cecil Rhodes, who Zimbabwe was, you know, called Rhodesia, right, after Cecil Rhodes, and these kind of sentiments about the need for Europeans to come in and civilize people who weren't civilized enough, right? And so, yeah, and it had real repercussions, and I think it's important to realize that. And just, and nowadays, I mentioned how ancient DNA is sometimes interpreted, right? There's in the news story a few years ago, some DNA samples were sequenced from Bronze Age Greek remains of these, you know, Greeks who lived in the Bronze Age. They were found to have some aspects of their DNA similar to modern day Greeks. This is certainly interesting, but it was used by far right parties to argue that, the, you know, these were Greeks, we were Greeks, you know, and we were autonomous. And, you know, and these were parties that were quite xenophobic, quite anti-immigration. And these kind of things, you know, they get into the news, into the news media, and are used as propaganda. So it's something that we have to be really careful about how we talk.
And I guess, you know, when you talk about the whole concept of migration, I think, you know, because right now we talk about the migration of humans out of Africa, out of sub-Saharan Africa, right? Mm-hmm. That's the accepted scientific consensus these days. That's how humans originated. But I would believe that, you know, based on what you're saying, even a century or two ago, the narrative that was being espoused, again, for these like social and political reasons was that, you know, humans originated from, I think, West Asia or the Mediterranean, like, and that was treated as like hard fact.
Conference was that you touched a lot on genetics.
The Garden of Eden seemed to be somewhere in Mesopotamia or something, and that humans kind of started there and they spread out, and this the fact that they dispersed in biblical terms was actually seen as very negative, right? They, mm-hmm. It was because they had the Tower of Babel, right? Their humans were all separated because they had sinned against God, and they spoke all these different tongues, and this was terrible. A lot of those biblical sentiments, I think, played into it as well. But a lot of it was actually the realization that that wasn't true, right? Mm-hmm. That the earth was actually really old. It wasn't just 6,000 years old, like the kind of biblical the biblical version kind of dictated. It was really, and that's what they were discovering in the 19th century, right? So there's the excitement. The earth is really old. Humans are themselves are really old. Mm-hmm. We've been around for a long period of time. And of course, what else are the Europeans doing at this time? They're colonizing the globe and coming into contact with people with vastly different life ways of their own. And they're trying to explain this, right? And oftentimes it became explained in Darwinian terms. This is also the era of Charles Darwin, right? Biological evolution. They applied that to societies as well and kind of started to see them as on this line spectrum of from savage to civilized. And those sentiments were certainly... We certainly propelled colonial and imperialist efforts, right? The idea that, well, we have to Christianize and civilize people and that we're doing a good thing. And so, and that fit into these arguments about things like Great Zimbabwe or the Serpent Mounds of Ohio, right? Oh, these people are not civilized enough. They couldn't have built these things. It must have been migrants from elsewhere who came and did this. Nowadays, you get things like ancient aliens theories doing essentially the same thing, right? These people aren't so civilized. Aliens must have built them. It's the same sentiments, right? It perpetuates these ideas of certain peoples, right? And And so
definitely we'll keep an eye out. It's a really fascinating history. And if it comes out before the podcasters, we'll definitely link it in the description.
It certainly wasn't an ivory tower.
It was a pleasure having you on the podcast. Definitely learned a lot today. Thank you.
It did. Yeah, the title was modeling, right? So once again, one of the big developments in the last 10, 20 years is not just ancient DNA, but computer science, right? Data science, big data, the analysis of data. And so that's also really changing what we can do, how we can think about, long-term patterns in history. The data that archaeologists work with is certainly not the amount of data that Google and Facebook are working with. It's probably laughable to them how small some of our data sets are. But some of the contributors to the conference and to the forthcoming edited volume used computational models to understand how humans and predict how humans would move through a landscape. I don't feel as confident talking about that because I certainly myself am not much of a computer scientist other than dabbling in website development. But they develop these kind of really fast, interesting models, mathematical models about how when humans are likely to migrate. A lot of the times it depends on, they talk about things like the carrying capacity of a region that they're living in. And so once the carrying capacity, the nutrition, the water, anything that humans need to live is kind of exceeded, this suggests, that they will migrate and they predict things like how they were will settle in certain places, how they will integrate with other societies. It's quite interesting. And I encourage people to seek out the volume if they're interested in learning more about how people do this. There's a couple, two or three chapters that look at these computational models. And they're really what we call predictive models, like what will people do in a given environment.
Yeah, definitely. We'll keep an eye out for that publication. And if it comes out before the podcasters, we'll definitely link it in the description.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was a pleasure having you on the podcast. Definitely learned a lot today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your interest. I really enjoyed talking to both of you. Great questions.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alirad, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we interview Dr. Megan Daniels, an assistant professor of ancient Greek material culture in the Department of Classical, Near Eastern, and Religious Studies at UBC. We hope you join us to listen again to Research Review in 2 weeks.